You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this episode, the first of 2012, I'm looking at short cult animation. Later in the show, I'll be talking to Sean Tan, the co-director of 2011's Oscar-winning short animated film, an adaptation of his acclaimed picture book, The Lost Thing. First, though, I'm talking to Jonty Picking, a web animator whose cult animated series Weeble and Bob has earned a loyal following on the internet, leading to adverts for Anchor Butter and Cadbury's Cream Eggs. I'm talking to Jonty Picking at the Bristol Small Press Expo in the Mercury Hotel. I was just actually eavesdropping on a conversation you were having with a punter. This isn't your first comic convention. You've been at the Thing in London before?
Yeah, I've been to the UK webcomic Thing. I think it was about two or three times. Okay. But this is the first big expo we've been to, I think.
Yeah. Where you've shared the room with superhero comics.
Oh, and yes. Lots of people here. It's like, oh, big names. Oh, I used to read that and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's really quite exciting.
What's the crossover been like, as far as you can tell, from people who are buying your stuff? Are there lots of small press comic creators who are into Weeble and Bob? Is there, you know, kind of a crossover audience?
I've spoken to a few of them. Yeah, it does seem to be a fair bit of like crossover. Not obviously a lot of the people who are making their own web comics, doing on the web as well. And so, yeah, they're kind of aware of each other as well. So, yeah, there's a fair bit of crossover, I'd say.
What was the initial genesis of Weeble and Bob? I've heard various tales about you and your friends doing funny voices and being inspired by, the toys.
Weeble's Wobble, yeah. To be honest, it was just me sat in front of a computer with Flash and going, I'm a bit bored. What is the simplest thing I can do and try and get away with? So I basically try to push it a little bit and see what people would accept as animation and voices. And the idea was like it descend into complete gibberish. But he's got a little, like their voices are like, so you know, fairly incomprehensible, so you have to read what they're saying. But as it's gone along, they've got a little bit more clear. So the plan's kind of backfired slightly from where I wanted to be originally. But, you know, that's good. I regret, in a way, that they are so simple. Because when you go, oh, I want him to look a little bit suave or a little bit frightened, and they've got no limbs and no features on the face, it's like, ah, this is too difficult.
And presumably, even in the early days, when you were coming up with individual animation starring Weeble and Bob, you come up with a kind of a gag for each story and then work around that?
Sometimes. It's more about the funny situation rather than an actual joke. Every now and again, we'd do an episode with a joke in. And that would have been written by Scoo, who I was working with on it, who's helping out again now, thankfully. And he'd come up with the actual jokes, whereas I'd just like, well, this is an absurd thing, and I find that amusing. Kind of like Monty Python never really did a punchline. This was a similar sort of thought to that.
And the supporting cast has grown and grown and grown over the years. Was that just so that you could, in a way, expand the number of situations and scenarios that you could put Weeble and Bob in? Because it's all very well that they can go to Dixon's and buy a computer, and that's hilarious when they meet the shop staff. But I guess when you have a supporting cast, it makes the stories you can tell a lot sort of broader.
Yeah, definitely. And having other characters to play with, you can obviously bring in different sort of personalities and reactions. And when I started doing the series for MTV way back, the head, who was like, he was a big fan, and that's why I went in and did it, he kind of explained what Weeble and Bob was to me. He said, basically, it's a giant soap opera with ridiculous idiots in. And it's like, yeah, I guess it is, in kind of way. So these little peripheral characters are kind of what give it the story arcs that are coming back, and a lot more colour than just two people rocking away talking about pie all the time.
Did you ever find yourself surprised by the cult following that the cartoon has attracted?
Absolutely. I just, because I never expected to be doing cartoons for a living, and now I've been doing it for nearly 10 years, I think.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's ridiculous that I've got to a point where I can just be stupid for a living.
Yeah.
But when it actually caught on and I was playing computer games online and people were starting over the microphones doing quotes and didn't realise who I was, they were just doing it, chatting amongst themselves, doing lines from my cartoons. Like, wow, this is something. It's quite, to be honest, it's a little bit disturbing at first and a little bit worried, but then it's like, oh, that's really cool.
Were those the kind of conversations that are actually people on microphones or just typed in?
No, a bit of both, because microphones had just started out then. But yeah, those that had microphones were all like, pie, and going, blimey, and loud beer.
So did you ever then do a Weeble and Bob and they'd go, you're not bad, but you're not as good as the person who does?
That had happened. It feels a little bit crash to do it. It's like, yeah, so I try and rein it in.
And then at some point along the way, obviously you were approached by Cadbury to do Weeble and Bob-themed cream egg commercials. How did that come about?
That was sorted out by our ad guys, who basically, that's why we're able to do what we do. The ad revenue is what keeps us ticking over. And jobs like that are what help to pay the animators to do the job they do, because I feel that they're doing a good thing, they should be paid well for it. I don't want to pay them peanuts. So it's nice when you get a job like that. And Cadbury's have been really good in that we'll go off and write something ridiculous and they'll go, yeah, go for it. So this year's been so much fun to do. I'm really pleased with how some of them have come out as well.
I mean, you know, do you see a day when you do get approached by a corporate client to do a cartoon and that's the point when they start censoring your work and you begin to feel uncomfortable with it? Or do you think, actually, the kind of level of product that you're doing at the moment, which gives you a fair amount of creativity, is kind of what you'd just like to continue to pursue?
It's kind of fun to do the commercial work because of the constraints that you're working under. You can't do this, you can't do that. As you're writing a script and you've got that in your head, then you're just like, I'm actually having to think more about what I'm writing. So it's kind of like flexing your muscles. And yeah, it's a good feeling when you've actually managed to do it and it's been signed off and it's still what you wanted it to be. So that's, yeah, I enjoy that, the restrictions, working within them.
On the Weeble and Bob website, there were various other cartoons, from other ongoing narratives like On the Moon to one-off gags that seem to be written around the ridiculous song that you've come up with. The format of the website then obviously gives you a fair amount of freedom. Is that that's something that you particularly enjoy, that you can go back and forth different types of projects?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can literally do whatever I want, and if it works online, then yay, I can do it. I don't really know where I'm going. My mind's gone blank. You'll have to excuse me.
Edit.
The fact that you can do infinite loops and drive people slowly insane, or do things that slowly change over time, that you couldn't really upload a 4-hour or 5-hour long animation to YouTube and have people sit all the way through. Whereas with Flash, people will actually sit and watch it because, I did one called Bone Dry Badger Hour, or it's just me in a garden for an hour with tiny little changes to the looping video, and then at the very end of an hour it finished and somebody saw a badger and people actually sat through it of virtually nothing.
How many?
I have no idea how many, but the fact that some people actually just sat through an hour of video was it amuses me that I can push people to do these stupid things.
Having gone from a sort of a one-man cartoon to a little bit of a sort of cottage industry, how many collaborators do you work with on the various cartoons?
On the cartoons, we've got 3 other animators. One in the UK, one in the US, and one in Australia.
Wow.
I've only met the one in the UK, obviously. But we all chat on IRC, which is an internet messaging service. So, or email, obviously, and pass files back and forth. So not actually meeting these guys or knowing what they look like or sound like, it's not really a problem these days. It's the way forward. It's nice that people get to work from their home where they're comfortable, and, you know, they can do other stuff as well. I don't hog their time.
And then doing the voices, do you have a fairly large cast, or is it actually just like a couple of you doing all the different characters?
It's mostly just me, to be honest. Every now and again, my wife, who helps write Catface, she'll do a voice for a female character.
Yeah.
But pretty much all the voices you hear are me. And I'm just sat in my shed doing crazy things, basically into a microphone. And half the sound effects are me as well.
And coming up with those different voices, do you use her as a sounding board, saying, do you think this suits a, you know, a talking cow, or does this suit a, you know, a shrimp, and so on and so forth?
Not really. She sometimes walks in halfway through me recording and just stare at me like I've gone insane and then leave. So it's playing around. Because I've got all the time to do what I like now, I can just play around, amuse myself. And if it is amusing to me, then I kind of assume it'll be amusing to other people. And if it's not, then, you know, serves me right.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
You can find more info and the latest animated work by Jonty Picking at www.weebles-stuff.com. That's weebls-stuff.com. Next, I'm talking to Oscar-winning animator Sean Tan. I'm Alex Fitch, and I'm at the Illustration Cupboard with Sean Tan at his exhibition, which is showing work from the last decade of this illustrator, writer, artist, and now award-winning animator. We have here a couple of pieces from The Lost Thing, the children's book that was turned into your Oscar-winning short. Mm-hmm. And it shows very much how your work is mixed media. We have a piece at the top, which is oil paint over the top of technical drawings and excerpts from various, looks like books of physics and
That's right.
And math, and at the bottom a much simpler sketch.
Uh-huh.
Could you speak a little about how you use mixed media in your work and how often you go straight into paint, or if it's more often that the case that you start off with a sketch and work from there?
Yeah, well, I always start off with sketches, often like this. This is back in the days before I had a computer too, or a photocopier. Mm. So I would draw little bits and pieces on paper and cut them up and rearrange them. So it was a way of composing an image. So I would have taken this little sketch and used it over the top of this painting and kind of moved it around to try and figure out the exact correct position. I did a lot of media experiments in those days, and with this particular book, because it's set in a world that's so kind of dry and mechanical, I wanted to incorporate this collage of physics and math textbooks. Mm. And also wanted the book to be incredibly dense, so there wasn't any white space in it at all. Everything's covered with stuff, like layers and layers of a past culture of something very mathematical. And then just allowing these little windows into which these images, very organic-looking images, might contrast with all that technical detail and the introduction of these strange creatures. And immediately when looking at it, I guess I found a sort of poetry in between the dry, hard-edged technical diagrams and these soft, tentacled shapes, which has become the core of the aesthetic for the whole book. And painted it in oil paint using watercolour brushes.
Okay.
Yeah, just in order to get the fineness of detail, and ruined many expensive watercolour brushes that way.
And the size of it, it's about three times the size it appeared on the page. Is that normally the kind of ratio you work at?
I do work three times the size. This is actually very small. I'm looking at it now, and I'd really forgotten about it. It's remarkably small.
Okay. Oh, was this a double page spread then?
Yeah, it was. Ah, okay. Yeah, so it's only about 120%.
Right.
And in some ways that sort of adds to the claustrophobic miniature universe that's created there. But I remember getting halfway through this book and thinking, this is way too small. So the latter half of the book I did at a much larger scale. It just technically became difficult. I like to work as large as possible, because I find it loosens me up. Small work can be very tight and constraining.
Cool. Well, shall we look at the rest of the exhibition?
Sure.
On this wall, we've got a variety of different sketches in pencil and charcoal
in ballpoint pen, which I guess is a mixture between the kind of work we might find in your sketchbook and then finished pieces that ended up in books like The Arrival.
Yeah, that's right. These particular sketches are taken, well, basically torn straight out of the sketchbooks for The Arrival, and there's many of them because it was such a huge project. And I went through hundreds and hundreds of drafts of each page, you know, often very quickly, trying out different ideas. It's a little bit like a manuscript. Instead of words, you have these tiny little diagrams and very crude drawings, because I'm not even worried about what they look like. I'm purely sketching concepts. So, and it's just enough for me to understand, almost like a doctor's prescription, like person running, people hugging, buildings, you know, and this sort of thing. And I'll, even when the drawings are really scruffy, I'll have written notes just to explain to myself. But it's showing the core thinking process. It's, often I'm reluctant to show this stuff because it looks so ugly to me, but at the same time, it's an honest revelation of the process that goes into what most people see in the printed book, which is highly rendered, polished work. That's not where I spend most of my time. Most of my time is spent doing all this mucking about with, you know, I always start by drawing a square and filling it with something, and then you see I've drawn arrows as I think about changing the order and so on.
Yes, when we last spoke, we talked a lot about The Arrival, about how it's a wordless graphic novel. I guess each project you do dictates the amount of words and the amount of pictures that are going to exist in, whether it's a book that has no words whatsoever, or, for example, with The Lost Thing, a book where the words actually become part of the texture of it.
Yes.
And I guess that approach, you kind of only know what you're going to use as you start on the project.
Yeah, that's right. And those decisions happen quite early on. They continue to be refined right up until the last moment. So with The Arrival, an early decision to drop all text, which created a whole lot of new problems, particularly in length, because it's you have to show things happening in a sequence. You can't jump suddenly because you'll lose the reader. Where there is text involved, such as a book like Tales from Outer Suburbia, is a constant balancing act between, well, should this part be illustrated? Should this part be verbal? So, for instance, with this image here, this scene in the story is not written about at all. But there's actually quite a lot of text that goes with this story. But in the middle of the text is a six-page silent section which shows a couple having a journey through the desert. And, you know, none of that is narrated, because it was more powerful just to show all these weird things happening and leave it to the reader to try and figure out what's going on. And then the text picks up at the end. The words generally do stuff that the pictures can't do, so often explain abstract concepts, which would be quite impossible to draw pictures of, I think. And the pictures show other things, showing really weird ideas that it would be impossible to describe. Like, you wouldn't be able to adequately describe that image in words. So a lot of it is to do with compression. Like, I'm trying to make stories as short as possible, and in doing so, I'm trying to think what's the most economical way of conveying an idea instantly but still have it being very mysterious.
Yeah. And also seeing the finished piece next again to one of your sketches, it ties in with the fact that this book, The Bird King and Other Stories, has just been released, which is a selection of preparatory work from various books that you've done over the last decade, including some of the storyboards for The Lost Thing. When it came to curating the book, indeed like curating the exhibition, what sort of decisions go into the process of finalising the examples that you're going to put in the book and the examples that you're going to put in the exhibition?
Well, it's difficult because there's so much material to start with. I mean, boxes and boxes of stuff. You know, because most of the work for a book is not published. It's the preparatory work. I guess I just picked my favourites, you know. I'm sure somebody else coming along would have made an entirely different selection. I'm particularly looking for those drawings which sort of talk back to me a lot, and also the ones I don't entirely understand. Like, I'm not quite sure why I thought of drawing that. So those continue to intrigue me, whereas a number of drawings, I'm very clear about what I was trying to achieve and so on, and they're somewhat less interesting for me. Also, with that particular book, I just wanted to represent a cross-section, mostly for... I was thinking, well, what would I like to have seen as an art student to reassure me that what the practice I was doing was worthwhile? And I would have liked to have seen the whole variety of what an illustrator does. And often, you know, those people who read books will only see book illustration, but it's very unlikely that anybody does just that. There's all sorts of things. There's, you know, like the sketches in fields, and there's the funny little creatures that don't really go anywhere. There's the ideas that for, you know, film or stage productions that aren't actually practical for the storyline, but they're still nice ideas. And so all of those things, you know, they're really interesting and often really scruffy as well, which is important to show.
Yeah. But also, I mean, I suppose it shows your process that the book also includes some of your life drawing, some of your landscape sketches, and also a collection of drawings that you did of ancient pottery in a museum in Mexico.
Yes, yeah.
And you can see, up to a point, the process that you've gone through, seeing the shape of a piece of pottery in that collection and thinking, what if it had tentacles? What if it had claws?
Yeah, for sure. And being pretty upfront about your influences as well. And so, yes, I do get a lot of ideas from museum objects because they're forms that are alien to me, particularly if they come from a non-Western culture or a very ancient. And I also trust old things and try to find ways in which I can integrate, you know, even if it's just a particular curve on a sculpture, not necessarily the idea of it or anything, into the work that I do. Yeah, a lot of those kind of sketches in the book are taken directly out of my notebooks. They were never intended to be published.
Okay.
And that was actually one of the rules I set for myself in selecting images, is they were all things that I never, at the time I was doing them, I never intended for them to be seen by anybody. And also, they're all works that were done in under 2 hours.
Right.
So there's a lot of beautiful sketches that I've done that I deliberately left out because they're too self-conscious. A lot of this work is really working stuff.
And like I said, there are a couple of storyboards from The Lost Thing in there as well, which is probably surprising to people, having seen your sketches, that they're actually fairly finished pieces as well, that they're full colour, they're painted.
Yes.
Was that important to you when it came to creating the animation, in order to make the transition from the print version of the book to something that obviously has 24 frames a second rather than one page a minute or whatever it was?
Yeah, the difference there is that I was working with a team of other artists, and the sketches I do, such as these, are for myself, and so I kind of know what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
But when working with other people, the more detailed the preliminaries are, the more helpful it is to them. Better to err on the side of excess detail. And the coloured sketches in particular were crucial because in a collaborative way of working, there are certain visual things that language is not adequate in expressing, and colour is one of those. Like, you can say something like the sky needs to be kind of orange, but there are a million kinds of orange, especially when they're put in relation to other colours. The only way to show these things is to sketch them out. And often I don't really know what I want to see until I actually start colouring it in. So the coloured sketches became critical for nailing the aesthetic of the final film. And I think part of the film's success is the palette, actually, that it is very carefully considered as a result of doing all these drawings and then testing the final digital imagery against the original, very quickly rendered sketches.
We spoke about how your artwork in its original format could be anything up to 3 times the size that it'll appear in print. This collection of your sketchbook work, though, is actually quite small.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because the sketches themselves are quite tiny and a lot of examples and wouldn't benefit from being blown up on the printed page?
Yeah, that's true. The book itself is about the same size as the sketchbooks that I often work in. At one point when putting it together, The book was actually a little bit too big, and so I resized everything. I said, you know, I got the sample from the printer, and I thought, it just feels a bit too big. It doesn't feel comfortable to me as being a sketchbook, so we reduced it a little bit. And, the sketches are generally reproduced at 100%. Nothing's blown up, that's for sure, but some have been reduced, but a lot of them are just as they appear in the sketchbook.
You spoke about how hopefully seeing some of the work that goes into the final product will be an aid to up-and-coming art students, but having the original sketches and your process kind of laid bare on the page, is that something that you found at all traumatic, kind of like laying open, you know, your soul to a certain extent to the reading public?
Yeah, a little bit. Like there's a final chapter in the book, or a fourth section, which is kind of straight from my primary notebooks, and often they're not very attractive. They're very scruffy, and they're just me thinking nonsense onto the page, you know, hoping that I'll come up with an idea. And so, you know, for me personally, I don't actually like showing that stuff, you know. But I thought it would be very useful for a student to see that, and also to realise that a lot of the work I do, you know, the creative work I do, is not that good looking. But what matters is the conceptual play that's going on. And I've seen that myself in the sketchbooks of other artists, and they've been a little bit the same towards me. You know, I don't look at that. Yet I'm fascinated by it. I think it's this funny thing, like, artists are always fascinated by other artists' sketches, but not so keen to show their own, because there's a lot of clumsy, unedited, awkward, unintelligible stuff going on there. A lot of dumb ideas, where we're so used to filtering out all the clever ones so that we can present those in finished artwork. But yeah, I thought it's good to be honest about the process, and hopefully a lot of younger artists will actually draw comfort from it, and thinking, you know, oh well, if he's drawing stuff like that, well, my sketchbooks look like that too. So you know, it's not like everybody's working on different levels. We all start from the same base.
Well, you speak in your introduction about Paul Klee and his idea of taking a line for a walk. Mm-hmm. That, you know, even if someone does have a dumb idea, if you put it down on a page, it then may lead to something that you're happy with. So you shouldn't just curtail your something.
Yeah, that's right. It's very important when doing creative work not to censor yourself, and to just dream very openly, and then review it later on, you know, to look for traces of things that make sense. But yeah, a lot of the process is just like that kind of open-ended play. And in my sketches, you'll notice a lot of them are produced with a ballpoint pen, and often on not very good paper, and the reason is that I don't see them as artwork, and I don't start feeling precious about them or worry about what other people are going to think when they see them. And I create much better ideas that way, better basic compositions for illustrations, when I'm not thinking that they're actually anything important. And a lot of the best ideas are actually a bit dumb when you first think of them. They just seem really stupid. And over the years, I've learned to pay attention to that feeling, because brilliant ideas are the same as stupid ideas in that they're all to one side of the normal railway of thinking. So, you know, a lot of the sketching is about trying to figure out which is which. Is that a brilliant idea or a stupid idea? Unless you actually pick it up and nurture it a bit, you'll never find out.
The exhibition downstairs is a selection of your work from various projects, and so as such, you've chosen pieces that perhaps complement each other. Mm-hmm. I imagine that the illustration gallery are going to hang on to a few of your pieces, either for a display for a few more months or as pieces that they might sell. And as such, they might end up in the area where we are now, the upper gallery, which has a selection of all sorts of different kinds of illustration work, children's books, animation, comics. And so your work will then be displayed with the work of your peers who are working very different disciplines. Is that the sort of thing that interests you? Because we were talking about how it's about time that comic book artwork and illustration artwork made it into larger gallery spaces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. It's like, yeah, it's great that things are given attention. The other thing about illustration too, and you see it when you look around at all this other work, is that the original illustrations look so much better than the printed illustration. It's just a difficulty of process. And the fact that you using different reflective materials when you paint. You can never quite get that in print. And I love looking at original illustrations and also being able to see how people have put them together without that kind of flattening out process that happens at that printing stage. So yeah, it's great that people have the opportunity to see them, but also that you know, everything is about context, the degree to which people invest their attention in a thing. And so the better the context, the better people are able to judge good or not or of personal interest to them. And I can't think of a better context than this.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Sean Tan's latest book, The Bird King and Other Stories, is available in all good bookshops now. And the limited edition Australian DVD of The Lost Thing, which includes a new miniature book of work, is available at the Illustration Cupboard at 22 Berry Street, London, SW1Y6AL, nearest tube, Green Park Station. The Electric Sheep podcast was introduced, recorded and edited by Alex Fitch, and there'll be a new episode online next month. Thanks for listening.